Today is Monday, February 1st, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, a military coup in Myanmar.
The Myanmar army declared a state of emergency and said it carried out detentions in response to election fraud.
Also ahead, a look at vaccines in Israel.
Israel has become a real-time laboratory for the Pfizer vaccine, which is being widely distributed in the country through the public health funds.
Plus, we meet a young sumo wrestler in Japan. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is the coup in Myanmar. Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other senior figures from the ruling party were detained in an early morning raid, the spokesman for the governing National League for Democracy said Monday. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Myanmar's military seized power on Monday in a coup against the democratically elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi. Other senior figures from the country's ruling party were detained in what the party spokesman called an early morning raid. On military-owned TV, the Myanmar army declared a state of emergency and said it carried out detentions in response to election fraud. Dozens of soldiers were around the city hall in major city Yangon shortly after the reported arrests. Phone lines to the nation's capital, Naypyidaw, were not reachable immediately after. Parliament had been set to start there on Monday after a November election. State-run television MRTV showed no signal and said in a Facebook post it had stopped its broadcast due to technical issues. A ruling party lawmaker who requested anonymity for fear of retaliation said Han Tar Mint, a member of the party's central executive committee, was among those detained. A military spokesman did not answer phone calls seeking comment. The arrests come after last November's election, which gave Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, a landslide victory. The military, which controls key positions in parliament and Suu Kyi's administration, has called the election fraudulent. But they promised over the weekend to protect and uphold the Constitution, after suggesting earlier that week they would abolish it, raising fears of a coup. Meanwhile, Myanmar's Election Commission has rejected the military's allegations of vote fraud. Suu Kyi came to power in 2015 in a landslide election, following decades of military house arrest in a struggle for democracy. She had won the Nobel Peace Prize for her effort, but her international standing was damaged after hundreds of thousands of the Rohingya people fled military violence in 2017. At home, she still remains widely popular.
That was Brian Wood of Reuters. Next, we head to Syria. United Nations aid agencies warn more than 120,000 people who have fled war in northern Syria are struggling to survive in refugee camps in the cold winter months. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs calls the situation catastrophic. It says humanitarian staff members are working around the clock to reopen muddied, debris-filled roads to reach victims of this disaster with emergency relief. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke reports heavy rains and strong winds have damaged or destroyed at least 21,700 tents that shelter tens of thousands of people at about 300 sites. He says one child was killed and at least three people were injured.
Many people who were already struggling to survive have had their food stocks and household items and other possessions washed away, and water sources were contaminated. In some cases, small children, the elderly, pregnant mothers, and other vulnerable people were left stranded in remote areas in the mud as temperatures dropped below zero.
These victims are among 2.7 million people who fled fighting in Idlib and other parts of northwest Syria. In November, Russian-backed government forces intensified their military offensive in Idlib, the last major rebel-held stronghold in Syria. OCHA reports increased airstrikes and ground fighting forced more than 235,000 people in Idlib to flee their homes between December 12th and 25th. Laerke says international support is desperately needed and that thousands of people have been cut off from basic supplies and services for days.
Humanitarian staff are now struggling to reopen access roads to reach the displaced in the northwest with emergency shelter, food, clean water, and other supplies. It is a massive undertaking, and the work will continue for months. So far, the international response has not matched the scale of the crisis.
Orchard says less than the half of the $49 million appeal it issued to help people survive the freezing winter season and deal with the flooding has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Afghanistan, international troops plan to stay in the war-torn country beyond the May deadline envisaged by the insurgent Taliban's deal with the United States. That's according to four senior NATO officials. The comments could escalate tensions with the Taliban, which have demanded full withdrawal. Flora Bradley-Watson of Reuters reports.
International troops plan to stay in Afghanistan beyond the May deadline agreed with the Taliban. That's according to four senior NATO officials who said there will be no full withdrawal of the 10,000 troops stationed there. The move is likely to increase tension with the Taliban, who said there will be consequences if the deal is violated. One NATO official told Reuters the circumstances had not been met for foreign troops to leave. Kabul and some foreign governments say the Taliban has failed to meet its promises, pointing to violence that has remained high, while also accusing them of failing to cut ties with Al-Qaeda. The NATO source, who wished to remain unnamed due to the sensitivity of the issue, added that under a new White House, there will be tweaks to the Afghanistan policy. Last year, the then US President Donald Trump signed an agreement with the Taliban, which called for the withdrawal of all foreign troops by May in return for the insurgents fulfilling certain security guarantees. Trump hailed the accord as the end of 2 decades of war, but it did not include the Afghan government. Talks between Kabul and the Taliban have since stalled. What happens after April is expected to be top of the agenda at a key NATO summit this month. NATO spokeswoman Oona Lungescu said, quote, "No NATO ally wants to stay in Afghanistan longer than necessary, but we have been clear, our presence remains conditions-based." The administration of Joe Biden has launched a review of the Afghanistan peace agreement. A spokesman for the Pentagon said the Taliban had not met their commitments, but Washington was yet to decide on future troop levels, while Afghanistan's presidential palace did not respond to a request for comment.
Thanks to Flora Bradley-Watson of Reuters for that report. As the U.S. is set to review its deal with the Taliban, the new U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said at his Senate confirmation hearing that, quote, "the administration wants to end this so-called forever war," end quote. For more on the U.S. role in Afghanistan, VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi spoke with David DeRoche, associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies.
It's important to note that we're kind of out of good options in Afghanistan. You know, the Barack Obama policy doesn't differ that much from the George W. Bush policy, which doesn't differ that much from the Donald Trump policy. And the reason for that is there's just not a whole lot of difference in what we can do that we're willing to do. So I think that there's no doubt that if you dig deeply in the records, you can find people who characterize attacks as being Taliban or being Taliban-driven, and that the Taliban, their leverage at the bargaining table comes from the fact that they can turn violence on or off. In order to get an agreement with them, there's a certain amount of overlooking and a certain amount of hypocrisy, to be honest, that has to occur, as occurred, for example, in Northern Ireland, you know, getting that accord. But at the end of the day, Biden doesn't want us in Afghanistan longer than we had to be, nor did Trump. And so I think that quite a lot of Taliban behavior is going to be overlooked in the interest of getting a deal that extracts us from that situation.
The deal with the Taliban comprised a pledge to begin withdrawing U.S. troops in return for security guarantees from the militants and a commitment to kickstart peace talks with the Afghan government. However, violence across Afghanistan has surged despite the two sides engaging in those talks since September. How could the Biden administration ensure Taliban's commitment?
That's the $50,000 question. Nobody is quite sure how you can ensure the Taliban will do anything unless we have a robust security presence. The Taliban is not a tightly organized, tightly led, disciplined organization. It's quite possible that, you know, affiliates of it will do things that the leadership has agreed they should not do. And we should prepare for that. And they are going to attack the Afghan security forces as soon as we create a vulnerability. And in particular, women in Afghanistan are going to be mistreated under Taliban rule. So I think that this is less about ensuring Taliban commitment and more of ensuring that we get a Taliban commitment, and then after the fact, once we've achieved our policy goal of withdrawal, arguing over whether the Taliban has kept to it or not.
But Secretary of State Antony Blinken told his Senate confirmation hearing that the administration wants to end the so-called forever war. What would that entail?
That's really the nub of it. I mean, there's two ways to do it. You can either do it with a military victory, which would require resources far in excess of what we have committed in the past and what we're willing to commit. And it would also require taking action in the safe haven that the Taliban has used, particularly in Pakistan, which would then destabilize Pakistan and may create bigger problems for us. Or coming to some sort of a negotiated settlement in which a lot of the things that we think are important, like protecting the rights of women, those are pretty much left up to the interpretation and the execution of the Taliban, which I don't think anybody trusts them on that subject. So what that means is that in order to achieve our strategic aim, which is to withdraw forces, we're going to have to probably compromise on some of the human rights and some of the local governance. And we're just going to have to make a geopolitical concern that Afghanistan is not worth the blood and treasure we've invested in it, that the Afghan government we've tried to build up remains corrupt and inefficient, and that, quite frankly, it's just not worth putting more money into a proposition that's not going to pay any dividends for us.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. At least 12 people have died, including 7 children, after 2 vessels sank close to a port on Colombia's Pacific coast, a naval official said Sunday. Gloria So of Reuters reports.
At least a dozen people died after 2 boats sunk off the coast of Colombia, 7 of whom were children. That's according to a Colombian naval official on Sunday. Admiral Jose David Espita told Reuters the vessels sank on Saturday near Tumaco, Colombia's 2nd most important Pacific port, and that the cause was still under investigation.
We sympathize and express our condolences to the victims and relatives. All institutions in San Andres de Tumaco will continue to work until they are able to find the missing people at sea.
According to local officials, the 2 vessels were filled with passengers when they set off from Tumaco towards San Jose del Guayabo in Costa Rica. Espita said none of the deceased were wearing life jackets. He added that it was unclear how many passengers remained missing, but that local residents and fishermen had saved 36 people so far. The news comes as Colombia grapples with a migrant crisis, with hundreds being detained as the country's borders remain closed due to COVID-19. Earlier this year, 4 Haitians drowned after their vessel shipwrecked off Colombia's Caribbean coast, where they had intended to sail off for Panama.
That was Gloria So of Reuters. This is VOA. Ugandan presidential challenger Bobi Wine on Monday launched a court case seeking to overturn the re-election of President Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power for 35 years. Museveni won the January 14 elections with 58% of the vote, while Wine had 35%, according to final results from the Electoral Commission. But authorities killed dozens of people during the campaigns, and after the vote, police surrounded Wine's home for days, with authorities citing an urgent need to prevent him from leading protests. There was also an internet shutdown that remained in force until 4 days after the vote, and social media sites remain restricted. The Supreme Court ruled 3 times that electoral irregularities were not substantial enough to affect the outcome. In Russia, a Moscow court has ordered the wife of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny to pay a fine of 20,000 rubles, or about $265, for violating protest regulations after she attended a demonstration in the Russian capital to demand his release. Tens of thousands took to the streets in dozens of Russian cities Sunday demanding that authorities free Navalny. Police arrested over 5,400 people, according to a group that monitors arrests. The 44-year-old Navalny, who was jailed last month and faces a prison term, is President Vladimir Putin's fiercest critic. His wife, Yulia Navalnaya, joined a protest in Moscow and was quickly detained and charged with participating in an unauthorized rally. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. In the first large controlled study outside of clinical trials, the two-dose Pfizer coronavirus vaccine is showing 92% effectiveness, Israeli health officials say. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The Maccabi Health Fund studied 163,000 Israelis who had received two doses of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine. Only 31 of them caught COVID-19 after they were fully vaccinated. In an equivalent sample of unvaccinated Israelis, almost 6,500 developed the disease. The study shows the Pfizer vaccine had 92% effectiveness, which was close to the 95% Pfizer saw in clinical trials. Israeli infectious disease experts said the study is good news and that the slight difference between the clinical trials and this current study is within the standard deviation. Israel has become a real-time laboratory for the Pfizer vaccine, which is being widely distributed in the country through the public health funds. Israel bought the vaccine early, paying double the market price, according to media reports, and agreed to share all of its data with Pfizer. All Israelis belong to one of four health funds, and all medical records are digitized. So far, almost 3 million Israelis out of a total population of 9.3 million have received the first dose of the vaccine, and almost 1.5 million have received the second dose. Despite the good news, the country is seeing a rising death rate and more seriously ill patients. Israel has been under a third lockdown for 3 weeks, which is due to be lifted next week. All schools and businesses, except for essential businesses like supermarkets and pharmacies, are closed, and Israelis are allowed to travel only half a mile from their homes. Some in the ultra-Orthodox community have ignored these restrictions, and there have been violent demonstrations when police have come to enforce them. Israel's health minister, Yuli Edelstein, says lifting the lockdown would be a mistake. He said the lockdown has stopped the increase in new cases, but the British mutation, which is being found in about a third of all new cases, is more infectious and more serious. He said that opening schools and workplaces now would be a big mistake and would result in more deaths. Of the total 4,600 deaths in Israel, more than 1,000 were in the month of January alone. Professor Nachman Ash, who is leading Israel's coronavirus response, said he is most worried about the number of seriously ill patients. He said that Israel currently has 1,200 seriously ill patients, and some hospitals are on the verge of collapse. He said in the next week he expects the numbers of seriously ill patients to begin to drop. Israel closed its airport this week to air traffic, hoping to stop new cases being brought into the country. Israeli officials say they hope to extend both the lockdown and the airport closure for another week. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Also in Israel, thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews ignored Israel's lockdown yesterday as they gathered for a top rabbi's funeral in Jerusalem. Edward Barron of Reuters reports.
Thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews attended the funeral of a top rabbi in Jerusalem on Sunday, ignoring a national lockdown. Israel's been praised globally for its speedy vaccination efforts. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had promoted a quick vaccination of Israel's most vulnerable and the lockdown as dual pathways to a possible reopening of the economy in February. But serious cases have surged among Israelis who've not yet been vaccinated. Officials blame this on foreign virus strains and on lockdown breaches. Israel's often high-density ultra-Orthodox communities make up around 15% of the population, but account for some 35% of recent contagions, according to the health ministry. They are among the conservative Netanyahu supporters, and their violations have been played up by political rivals in questioning the lockdown's efficacy and building opposition to the prime minister ahead of a March 23rd election.
That was Edward Barron of Reuters. In other lockdown news, the city of Perth in Western Australia has entered a 5-day lockdown after a security guard working at a quarantine hotel tested positive for the virus. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Just a single new COVID-19 case. has sent most of Western Australia's 2.7 million residents into lockdown. It highlights the nation's very cautious response to the pandemic. It's not yet known how the security guards working in a quarantine hotel in Perth for travellers returning from overseas contracted the virus. Schools, restaurants and gyms will close for at least 5 days. Only essential travel is allowed and masks must be worn. Western Australian Premier Mark McGowan believes the state is dealing with a highly contagious strain of coronavirus that first emerged in Britain.
We are told the guard was working on the same floor as a positive UK variant case. The guard completed two 12-hour shifts on both the 26th and 27th of January. Exactly how the infection was acquired remains under investigation.
Epidemiologist Nancy Baker says the lockdown in Western Australia has come as a shock to many people.
They're kind of living their lives as if COVID didn't exist. So now when you have someone who may have been in the community for 4 to 5 days in an infectious state, it's possible that the virus has spread widely. It's likely the more infectious variant of the virus, either the UK virus or the South African variant of the virus. So there's even more potential for it to have spread widely. So, you know, I think this is a precautionary approach.
Other states and territories have imposed restrictions on travellers arriving from Western Australia. The protocols in other parts of Australia are very different. Health officials have said up to 30,000 tennis fans will be allowed to attend the Australian Open each day. The tournament starts in Melbourne next week. Authorities in Queensland are reopening the state border on Monday with New South Wales after COVID-19 outbreaks in Sydney over the holiday period were contained. A so-called travel bubble has reopened between Australia and one of its closest neighbours after no new COVID-19 infections were detected in New Zealand. Passengers entering Australia will be screened before and after flights for the next 10 days, but will no longer have to go into quarantine upon arrival. Australia closed its international borders to foreign travellers in March. Those controls are expected to remain for the rest of this year. The Health Department Monday estimated there were 66 active coronavirus cases in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
At twice the size of other kids his age, a young champion sumo wrestler in Japan can shove around his older counterparts. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports.
At just 10 years old, Japan's Kyuta Kumagai is already a world champion sumo wrestler. He weighs 85 kilograms, eats as much as 4,000 calories a day, and beats boys 5 and 6 years older than him.
It's fun to beat people older than me.
Kumagai trains 6 days a week at a local temple, lifting weights and working on his flexibility. It often leaves him breathless, bloody, and crying. His dad, Taisuki, entered his son in his first tournament when Kyuta was just in kindergarten.
I didn't teach him anything. He could do various things naturally. There's a talent for sumo, and he has that talent. He won the tournament. I thought he may have something special.
Dr. Daniel Gould is director of the Institute for the Study of Youth Sports at Michigan State University. He says parents pushing children in sports should consider more than early wins.
We always tell parents, you want to be kind of thinking of your kid, where are they in their cognitive development? Where are they in their emotional development, social development? Where are they in their physical development? If you're going to play them up an age group or in a, you know, send them away from home to train, you really want to be looking at those three boxes and make sure they're all this, you know, all ticked off.
Taisuki Kumagai moved his family to a part of Tokyo famous for producing sumo wrestlers. Now, Kyuta trains with former professional sumo wrestler Shinichi Taira.
He has great talent. He's a hard worker and his parents are very enthusiastic. I think that's why he won the national competition. His future will be interesting.
Training can be expensive, but Taisuki says instead of gambling, he's betting big on his son. He also says Kyuta needs to gain another 20 kilograms over the next 2 years by the time he reaches middle school. The hope is for a high-profile sumo stable to take him in. Experts like Michigan State's Dr. Gould say that decision should be driven by the young athlete. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
That was Arash Arabasadi, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.